Välkommen till Hästveterinärerna, en podcast från Boehringer Ingelheim Animal Health. I den här podden samtalar vi med specialister från olika områden inom hästmedicinen. Med det gemensamt att de delar vår och din passion för hästarna.
Det är dags för ett nytt avsnitt av Hästveterinärerna, podden för dig som är veterinär eller djursjukskötare och arbetar med hästar. Vi fortsätter på samtalet med Martin Krarit Nielsen och pratar lite mer om utmaningarna man står inför som hästveterinär. Både när det gäller resistens, diagnostik och behandling, men också när det gäller att hantera missförstånd och utbredda missuppfattningar i ett område som ju berör de allra flesta hästmänniskor på ett eller annat sätt.
So we kind of got in a little bit from one thing to the other, but I was going to ask you what are the main challenges for equine vets when it comes to parasitic control or treatment or diagnostics or whatever. I think that this is probably one of them, I guess, the different difficulties in diagnosing, or perhaps the difficulties in detecting those individuals for which is going to be a problem and those not. But what would you say, are there any other or the biggest challenges that equine vets have?
Yeah, that's a great question. I can think of a couple. I mean, I think one of them is just the ever-developing resistance situation. And so we're getting more and more resistance. We get more and more reports of resistance in parasites to various classes, and it's just getting more and more. And since it doesn't ever go away once it's developed, that situation just becomes trickier and trickier. So maneuvering that as a veterinarian can be difficult. I mean, in addition to the ascrids and the sciathostomins that I talked about, there's also a lot of resistance in Oxyuris equi around the world. Not as widely documented, but it's documented in very different countries and different continents. And so there's definitely a lot of resistance to moxidectin and ivermectin documented. And there's also, in some countries, especially in the United Kingdom, they complain that they really feel like nothing works. There's the whole hyperemia situation with the somasaurus that some veterinarians in some part of the world also complain that, you know, nothing really seems to work against those somasaurus. I think that is a little bit more difficult to interpret because none of the products were ever labeled to actually treat somasaurus, because they were tested to treat the parasites in their normal setting, which is the stomach, not in a wound or some sort. So maneuvering the resistance situation and having effective products to treat with is actually becoming a challenge. And as I mentioned, there are examples already of triple drug resistant sciathostomins now. I think what saves us a lot of time is that the sciathostomins only rarely cause disease. The other one is definitely the diagnostics. I mean, I certainly like to focus on diagnostics and more and better diagnostics and a diagnostic for every parasite in every stage of interest. I'm very much supportive of that, and I've certainly done some work myself, and my lab has done work on those aspects. But I also think there's a limit as a veterinarian in practice in terms of how many tests you can have your clients pay for.
Yeah.
I think there's a practical limitation there. I mean, so we can be idealists and think of a whole panel of diagnostic tests that we can test every single thing for. But in the end of the day, the client is going to pay. And in many countries, not so much in the Scandinavian countries, but in many other countries, they can look at the cost of all these tests and the cost of the next cheap dewormer down in the feed store. And I know what they're going to pick. And even in here in these countries, there is a limit to how many tests you can basically charge your client for. And so there are clients that really want to do the right thing and want to pay for the best diagnostic and have all the information. There are clients like that. And by all means, we should definitely support them. If they want to do the right thing and you can pat them up on the shoulder and go, great, you're doing the absolute right thing here. You're getting all the right information. By all means, accommodate those clients. But there's also clients that can't or won't, or can't pay, won't pay, or just against the whole thing. Veterinarians are just in the world to make money and blah, blah, blah. So there's that too. And so sometimes I'm just an advocate for a little bit of pragmatism every once in a while. Mm. And I do think that you can be a pragmatist, but still be evidence-based and scientifically correct.
Mm.
And certainly recommend a given diagnostic test when you think there is a reason to do so. But there's a difference between that and then doing it routinely. So maybe some of these diagnostic tests can become cheaper and cheaper. Maybe there's a new technology waiting in the future that will basically circumvent this whole situation, because there's like this one catch-all thing that we can now do that will diagnose every single parasite for nothing. So, and that would be great. But I think there, what I'm saying here is that there should still be also an argument and a place for strategic, somewhat prophylactic treatments as well.
Yeah.
So not that we should just blindly do so, which is the mistake of the past, but I think we can sort of do it more wisely now with the information we have.
Yeah. So would you like to say something really short? How, in your experience, the main challenges for horse owners? We've been talking a lot about vets, and obviously, because this podcast is directed to vets, but vets also help horse owners. And I imagine that there is a little bit of a big difference in what you think of as a challenge, or what you think is challenging if you're a vet. Or if you're a horse owner. So what would you say, and maybe that also differs from between North America and in the north of Europe.
Mm.
Do you have a comment on that?
I spend a lot of time communicating with horse owners. Mm. Really a lot. In recent years, I've joined forces with these Facebook groups.
Mm-hmm.
There's a Sparrow Hestedyrlæge in Danish,
there's a
Horse Vet Corner,
mm-hmm.
Which has over 200,000 followers now. And there's questions about everything.
Yeah.
But I
must say, I adore the vets that give of their time.
Yeah.
I think it's absolutely amazing.
Right. But I think there's a lot of value in it for me as well. So not being in practice, but I have two audiences whenever I do that, because sometimes I hope some of the vets might also read along.
And
I try to sort of jump in before some of the other vets, because I may have more updated information.
Mm.
So I do see a big mission with that. And of course, that's a somewhat selected population, because those are people that are really keen on getting information. But there's a lot of horse owners that really, really, they have an appetite for information.
Yeah.
And they want the latest, the greatest, the most up-to-date information. And I often encounter horse owners being extremely open to information, and also very capable of actually handling the information and understanding it and digesting it. So in many ways, I feel like whenever I give talks to horse owners, I usually don't change a whole lot compared to when I talk to vets.
Mm-hmm.
Vets are a little bit more skeptical.
Yeah.
I think I can say that, because I think I do that myself. You tend to be a little bit more defensive when mm-hmm. this is something you're supposed to know about or you are knowing, you do know something about it. So you're a little bit more defensive to whatever this weird guy now has to say, right? Whereas a horse owner is just like, tell me, just give me information. And so sometimes it's a more, I don't know if I can say an easy audience to talk to horse owners than vets. I mean, I think skepticism is a good thing, right?
Yeah.
So I do appreciate the skepticism and the critical questions, but it's just a little bit of a different dynamic. So what's the major problem for horse owners? I think there's a couple things that are classic horse owner things. There's still this, I don't want my horse to have worms. I like this idea of keeping my horse parasite free. So that's a notion that's around a lot, and that's a misconception, because it'll never be accomplished.
Yeah.
And horse owners are not necessarily always receptive to that message. So I think that's something I spend a lot of time on. A classic question on any of these four I mentioned is like, okay, I deworm my horse. like yesterday or 2 days ago, and now there's worms in the feces. When do I deworm it again? And I always go, the whole point with what you just did was for worms to come out with the feces. Yeah. So this should not surprise you. Yeah, I don't know why. And it should also not lead you to want to do anything right away. Mm. It's just what should be happening. I mean, and so that conversation, so there's a psychology there where people are very, very reluctant or very, very sort of eager to go in and deworm a second time when they see dead worms coming out. So that's an interesting, not a big problem, but it's just an interesting sort of mindset that we see. So that's one horse owner thing. What was the other thing? And then of course there's skeptics. We probably seen that more and more in recent years, like the vaccine skepticism. Now this isn't vaccine, but it's chemistry.
Yeah.
There's this whole I want to use something natural.
Yeah.
And then there's horse owners around that will tell you what works, and they use this, that, and the other, and how it just works beautifully. And so that sometimes can be a difficult sort of situation to tackle, because these herbal things, herbal products, some of them even have names that might imply that they should have some activity against worms. But whenever we get a chance, it doesn't happen very often, but when we do get a chance to actually evaluate some of these herbal supplements, they don't do anything. Yeah. I mean, I want to keep an open mind and say that, you know, somewhere out there, there's probably a great dewormer just waiting to be discovered, just like ivermectin, which was a natural occurring compound produced by a bacterium in the soil. Now, but most of the time, there really isn't anything, and some of these supplements are just quack. I mean, they're being sold. You know, wording is chosen very carefully so that they're not, you know, marketing it as medicine, but they do imply that there's an efficacy. Mm. And there's horse owners out there that would not accept a statement that they don't work, even without any evidence to back their stance up. So sometimes there's that going on. One of the biggest ones, not in Scandinavia, but outside of Scandinavia, is diatomaceous earth. Mm-hmm. In the U.S., there's so many people that believe that diatomaceous earth works and kills parasites, and they get very, very upset when I tell them there's absolutely no...
What is that? Sorry for asking.
Diatomaceous earth is... it's a mineral, sort of a shell from some microorganisms that have long passed, and they're like diatoms. Mm-hmm. And they create this little shell surrounding them, and these shells are a little edgy, sharp. And there's this idea that if horses eat them, or any animal, it would cut the worms in two and then kill the worms. Mm. And there's so many people who believe so strongly in it that I get really hordes of people, you know, getting really angry with me and accusing me of being bought by the big pharma and all that stuff. It's very, very interesting. There's just this psychology surrounding diatomaceous earth for some reason, and really, really almost only diatomaceous earth. People are not as strong proponents for other natural things, but that's just a thing that many, many people believe that works. So sometimes we encounter that, and I'm sure that vets in Scandinavia probably also experience some of this, at least to some extent. So I think those are challenges, you know, with horse owners, but also their vets and that interaction with the vets, they wanna go for something natural, and they don't like this whole idea of shoving more chemicals in their animals. And so, you know, to some extent, they buy into my messages, which are you don't need to deworm as much as you have in the past, and people like that. But then sometimes I get the other extreme of the spectrum too. So
they say that everything from the US, they eventually make it to Europe. Let's hope this stays.
Diatomaceous earth and the whole sort of movement, I want to say, behind it has been around for a very, very long time. And it hasn't really made it to Europe yet. I have seen it a little bit in some of these supplements that have been sold, at least in Denmark, where there was one that said in Danish, diatomjord. Uh-huh. So that's a direct translation. So yeah. I've seen it, but I haven't seen it catch on to the extent that it apparently has in the
Not
States.
Not yet a hype. Let's yeah. hope it stays
a yeah.
hype. So last but not least, to sum this up, sort of, if you would take a look in the crystal ball, and when it comes to future innovations and development in this area, not only diagnostics as we've been talking a lot about, but in general, in which area would you say it's most important to do more research? In which area would you like to see more research being done, or what's I should probably ask, in which area are you going to research the most? What's the future there?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much we don't know, which is astounding. So I think, you know, speaking to a person from a pharmaceutical company, I do want to say that we need new dewormers. And I think that is very much a responsibility of the pharmaceutical industry. I think as a university-based scientist, we can participate in that, but we don't have the you know, the power, the and the financial backing to lead this effort, and it is certainly very needed. So it's certainly something I would like to see. I don't imagine a world without anthelmintic products, and we need new products with new modes of action. I mean, the newest mode of action is 40 years old, right? And it's like 40 years, that's ridiculous. That's a ridiculous amount of time where we've been stuck with the same three actives for nematodes plus one additional one for tapeworms that came along. And so that's definitely a big need. But I think on the more basic science level, we actually really don't have a clue of what the mechanisms of drug resistance even are. I mean, so I think when I started my career in research, I think there were lots of optimism that we're gonna crack that nut. We're gonna find the genes that confer resistance, and then we can have genetic tests, and then we also understand how to bypass those mutations and all. And there's been a little bit of work done, but we kind of feel like it's never the whole picture, and it's so multigenic and multifactorial that we still really don't understand the mechanisms of anthelmintic resistance. And so there's a lot more work to be done there, because I think once we have a better foundation of understanding, and this is not just in horse parasites, it's in all the parasites, we don't know this. Once we have a better foundation of understanding there, I think it will also enable us to design new drugs in the future. And so that's going to be a big area of understanding. So I think, you know, genomics is... And genetics is finally becoming more affordable for us to do, to get sequencing, DNA and RNA sequencing. I talked about the microRNAs before. That's an interesting area. So Katrine Toft and Tina Peel are focusing on diagnostic potential, but there's also a lot of basic biology in that. Mm-hmm. Like just understanding what are these things doing and why are they being released by the worms and what's the benefit, and can we maybe affect this somehow or shut it down? I mean, there's so many questions all of a sudden. So a lot more basic science that I think we can ask and address. I also think that some of the work that we've been doing and that they're doing both in Sweden and Denmark is to, you know, do parasitology without just focusing on the parasites, but actually focusing on the horses that have the parasites. And I think it sounds silly to sort of highlight that as something that's important, but in parasitology research in general, there hasn't been a whole lot of focus always on the host and the implications for the host. So I think this interplay of host parasite interactions, the inflammatory modulation that the parasites might be instilling, what are the adverse reactions? As I think you gathered from the webinar, we actually struggled in those studies that we did with finding a whole lot that's actually going on that can be ascribed to the parasites or killing parasites in horses with various anthelmintics. So I do think that there is a whole lot more work to be done there also. So yeah, parasites most of the time do not cause disease, but sometimes they do, and sometimes when they do, it's really, really bad. So, and there's more to it than just how many parasites a given horse might have. I mean, there's definitely much, much more to it than just trying to count or quantify the number of worms and say, if there's this many worms, then the horse is at risk for parasitic disease. There's all these other factors at play. We understand them so poorly. So, you know, I would really, I mean, I know this is part of what we're doing, certainly really diving deep into some of these big oceans of, you know, information that we just don't know yet and don't understand yet, and try to reach a higher level of confusion. it's fascinating. So certainly I think there's much more to be learned. I think what we'll see in equine parasitology, as well as in a lot of other equine scientific fields, is the big data era, right? Where you get like vast amounts of information. And then it becomes a whole challenge in itself to, you know, mine through all that data and make sense of it. But, you know, with the genetics, the genomics, the transcriptomics, the metabolomics, all of this stuff that we now can do that we couldn't do just a few years ago, it enables us to get so much more information about these worms. And the worms are going to be around. They're not going to go away. So, you know, for practitioners listening here, you know, whether you like it or not, and I don't have to tell you this, but whether you like it or not, you know, questions about parasites and parasite control are going to remain part of your practices for the rest of your careers and beyond that. So they're never going to go away. There's always going to be these questions.
Yeah.
And hopefully we get better and better at handling these things. So.
Yeah, that sums it up quite well. Thank you so much for being on this podcast with us, Martin Nilsson. It was a pleasure having you here.
I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.